listening to The Unlabeling Effect. We gather here every other week to explore all things mental health. Let us be part of your support system to inspire and motivate you to take care of your well-being. We, Vivian, Risha, and myself, Melody, welcome you to our UE community.
We have an inspiring entrepreneur today, Raina Chan, with us, who not only is an expert in the beauty and wellness industry in Hong Kong, founded Labo, and now incorporating the concept of mindful beauty and treatments in Vegas 360 Club Spa in Hong Kong. In addition, she was also in the top 10 finalist of Miss Hong Kong 2022 beauty pageant. Raina went through some big life-changing events that had changed her worldviews and made her appreciate the most fundamental things in life that we sometimes take for granted.
Thank you for being on The Unlabeling Effect with us today, Raina. It's our absolute pleasure. And without further ado, let's get started. I'm your host, Melody, and with me here today are Raina, Risha, and Vivian. Welcome.
Hello.
Thank you, Melody, for that nice introduction.
Thank you for being here. So how are we doing? It's a Sunday, a little gloomy outside.
Yeah. Very good. I'm feeling very at peace, even though we had a couple of drinks last night, but
yes. Still feeling very good today.
Yes.
The meditation helped.
Yeah. Yes. So let's share with the audience like how we met, right? So a friend of ours recently organized like a flower shopping day. It was like a very wholesome wellness, just looking at beautiful flowers day. We grabbed a coffee, we're connected.
And we started talking about mindfulness. Yeah. So I actually got told a lot about you.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned about the podcast you're doing. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as I looked into it, I was like, oh, she must be a beautiful soul because of the concept that you're into. I think it's rare to find that in Hong Kong these days. So that was a very nice intro as well.
Yeah. And our mutual friend.
Yes.
Baz is also on Unlabeling Effect. He's also so kind to have allowed us to use his art space and studio in Hong Kong. Beautiful, with a beautiful view in front of us. So we would love to have our audience who get to know more about your story.
Yes, so I did international relations at King's, and the reason why I did international relations is because initially I was really into psychology, but then when I got in touch with international relations, I was like, actually, this is psychology on a macro scale, because at the end of the day, politicians are human beings. And if you look at like the global stage and like the balance of power, sometimes it's like kids competing for power. So I found that very interesting, and that's why I studied that. And I was also very into philosophy, history, economics, and that gave me a very comprehensive worldview of how like the foundation of society works. And then I did a master's in management because we've got a family business in beauty, and I thought that will always be something safe to have if I do decide to go into the business industry. So after I finished my master's in management at LSE, I came back towards the end of 2020, initially just to visit my mum, but then unluckily at the end of 2020, I think around December or so, I found out about my tumour, which is the reason why I then decided to stay in Hong Kong.
And then what was like, it must have been like a really shocking news, right? And how old were you then?
So now I'm 25. I was 23 when I found that out. It was very shocking because I just finished my studies, and I think whilst you're looking forward to like starting your life properly, you know, after studying, I just couldn't believe that something like that could happen, especially I was still so young. And I think sometimes when you're young, you think you're invincible, which is very silly. It teaches you. I mean, when you go through something like this, it teaches you to put everything into perspective and just realize that life can be taken away from you at any time.
Yeah, and we tend to take our health for granted when we're at that age.
Yeah.
Just eat whatever, drink whatever.
Exactly.
You know, do whatever.
Sleep whenever.
Wow. And then how did you emotionally handle that journey?
It's strange because I came back July 2020. And I think for two or three months, I was already feeling weird because subconsciously I felt like something was wrong with me. Like I had this message in my head that I was dying, which is strange and difficult to understand as an outsider because your body don't really send you messages like this unless something is really wrong. And then so I went to a doctor to get checked up, and he was like, you're 22. Sorry, I was 22 back then. He said, you're 22. There's no way that anything could happen to you, because I was asking him, I was like, could I have cancer? Because I feel like I have cancer.
So you just felt sick, or your body was just
I would have weird thoughts all the time. Like, I'll have panic attacks as well because I'll be so anxious at the idea of dying, even though I just had a bloated stomach, and that's why I went and get checked up. But then another thing was, I was going to a theatre class back then, and the monologue I got was almost the exact description of how I was feeling during that time. It was about a guy who was about to have a heart attack, and then he was having all those anxiety and like thoughts and stuff, and I was like, this is such a joke because this is exactly how I've been feeling. Yeah. So that was like another message from the universe, and I believe in the energy, the universe, God. So I think when something is wrong, like, you will know. My intuition was getting stronger and stronger, and that's why I started having panic attacks, because I was so convinced at the idea that I was gonna die. It was very strange because I was telling my mom about it, telling my friends as well, and my mom was like, don't be silly, you're so young, like, you don't need to waste like $4,000 plus to spend on a CT scan when the doctor, when a doctor, you know, because the doctor is so authoritative and you should believe in a doctor. She was like, when a doctor tells you you're fine, you're fine. And then, so then he gave me some antibiotics anyways, because he said, oh, if you're feeling bloated, maybe you're too stressed, maybe you're not eating enough, maybe he was just giving me all kinds of reasons. So now I took the antibiotics. I think I waited for 2 months until I was like, okay, this is it. I need to go get a CT scan just for peace of mind. So now I insisted on the CT scan. And because like usually after you get the scan, it takes you, it takes 4 to 5 days to get the report back. And as soon as I got off the scan, like, I asked the nurse straight away, I was like, do I have cancer? And she was like, we can't tell you just yet. You need to wait, like, to have your reports and stuff. But I was so convinced. That's how convinced I was. And then I went down, and I went down to the clinic to pay. And then the nurse was like, oh, can you come into the room? Because the doctor needs to have a quick word with you. And when I heard that, I was like, something is wrong, you know. So went to the room. The doctor that told me I'm fine and that I didn't need a scan, he looked at my report and he was like, there is a huge tumor behind your stomach. Your stomach is displaced to the right. Your spleen is rotated and your kidney is squashed. And I heard that, I was just like, I didn't know how to react. Like, it was so surreal. It feels like you're in a nightmare, you know? I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. And he was, I was just like, am I gonna die? Because this is my only concern, right? If you're telling me I need a surgery, maybe I'll be disabled, whatever. I just don't want to die. I barely started my life yet. And then he had the audacity, I'm sorry, but he had the audacity at that point to be so not empathetic and say, you know, we're all gonna die one day. That's what he told me. Like, after breaking the news to me, when I went to him a couple months ago and he said, I'm fine. So if I just believed him and not having went to the scan, I could have dropped dead on the street because my, because of a kidney failure, you know, because my kidney was hanging on to his dear life, if you look at the scan.
Sorry, Reina, did you have any physical symptoms, or you just feel tired, or?
It's more of the mental.
It's the more of the mental bit, and the physical symptoms were mostly bloated. But then
just
kind of,
bloated.
Exactly, just bloated. But then you'll get the bloatedness if you,
if you're a woman.
Exactly, if you're a woman, PMS, you know.
Exactly. How did you process that news when you got back?
I was in so much shock, I didn't know how to process it. I think it's the first time I didn't know how to feel. Like, it was too much fear and shock. I think I couldn't speak at that moment. I was just like, okay. Crying doesn't help. Because usually you cry, it's just like an outburst of like expression, right? I couldn't express myself, and then I called my mom. My mom didn't see the scale of like how big the tumor is. She thought I can just do a keyhole surgery. It was going to be like something small. Anyways, I called my mom. I called my best friend, and my best friend came to me straight away. And then we had a dinner together, kind of just preparing me to get the surgery straight away in like a couple of days. The biggest realization to me at that point was time collapsed into the present. Because usually you're always ruminating between the past and the future. Right? You're never really in the now. But to me, I was like, I only have the now because I don't know if next week will come. And every night going to sleep, I didn't know if tomorrow will come, because it's like there's a time bomb in you. Like, imagine just knowing there's a 23 cm tumor in you. That's like a alien egg.
After the surgery, when during your recovery time was when you started to adopting new mindsets or challenging your previous mindsets? Like
all the realizations rushed in whilst I was waiting for the final judgment. The final judgment of knowing that I'm that it's benign instead of malignant, because I was the 5 days that I waited to get admitted to the hospital was where I was like, okay, all these things that I used to care about, how people think about me, the fear of trying things because you're scared of failing, or getting angry over little things, not being able to let go because, you know, as humans, we can get so stuck up in our little way sometimes, in this little hamster wheel that you're like, I need things to be like this, otherwise it's the end of the world. Like all of those thoughts just got out the window. I was like, none of this ever mattered. And I don't know why it did it before. I think it's when you can taste death, nothing is scarier than it. So then everything becomes so insignificant and you can put things into perspective. And I think that's the biggest realization I had.
And is that why you got inspired to work on or started Growth Junkie?
Yes. So I started Growth Junkie because I was always very, I was always a big advocate of self-development. I've got like maybe hundreds of pages of notes just on what I've learned from the people I've spoken to, the lessons or like sudden realizations I have in life or my favorite quotes or like things from books. And Growth Junkie is a product of those notes. It's a platform where I share all the things I've learned from life.
And is it currently like an Instagram page?
Mainly focusing on Instagram because I think you still need to deal with the realities of life, which is that you only have that much time. And then so I've found the fastest way to share is through Instagram at the moment. But eventually I hope maybe it can turn into a podcast or like a website or something, more accessible.
Can you tell us more, like, how did you, after your surgery or your recovery, you then pivoted into this industry and now incorporating like wellness, mindful treatments into like a beauty routine for a lot of people in Hong Kong, especially where it's a city that is just has a lot of noises, very busy, very fast paced.
My mom has always been in the beauty industry. And having grown up in the beauty industry, there is a huge pressure, especially in Hong Kong, that you have to look a certain way to be beautiful. Because we also know that an Asian beauty standard is so much more rigid. And having grown up in that environment, I always thought of the idea that when you don't feel beautiful inside, regardless of how beautiful you are outside and how often it is that someone compliments you, you don't feel it inside out. And that aura, that charisma is not coming out because you don't believe in yourself and you're not comfortable in your own skin. And with that idea, especially after the surgery, I had an opportunity to start my own beauty clinic. I thought, okay, what can I do to combine the two? So I thought of mindful facial, which is when the customer is getting pampered outside, we can also put her in like mindfulness state, if you like. So then before the facial, we'll do a small meditation. We'll check in with their emotion. So we used to have those emotional card and they will choose the emotion, and based on that we'll choose an essential oil that uplifts or like help to alleviate the sadness, for example. And the room will be set to complement all the five senses of the customer. So then with that, we can help the customer to come back to the present. So then there were like different tools that we put into the facial. So the customer can feel like not only is she getting pampered outside, but she's also feeling more in touch with her inner self. I'm trying to bring that concept into our club spas under Vegas 360. It's the exact same concept, but just bringing into the different branches.
And I've heard you've included singing bowl, like all kinds of different therapy to help stimulate or relax the soul of your customer. Tell us more about like also within your beauty sector. I know that you participated in the Miss Hong Kong. Like how was that like, or like why did you decide to do that and what did you learn? Like I guess it must have contributed a lot towards who you are right now, right?
That was a very spontaneous decision to do Miss Hong Kong. I went traveling for 3 months after the surgery, and then I was like, you know what? I'm gonna go traveling because who knows how long you have on this beautiful earth, right? So then I went traveling, and then towards the last bit of my travel, my mom called me and she was like, "Hey, it's the 50th anniversary of Miss Hong Kong. You're 25. it's a nice number, you know?
That's my first thought when you said like 50th anniversary and you're 25. I was like, ooh.
Yeah, exactly.
She's like, oh, you grew up with Hong Kong because like 1997, the return back to China. Anyways, yeah. She was like, why don't you try it? It will be a good life experience. And also maybe you could share your story to motivate people who might be in the same shoes. And I was like, you know what? I've got nothing to lose. And I've got a huge scar down my stomach. They might not even like take me in anyways. I might as well try. So then I just did it. It was a very spontaneous decision. And then they liked me, I think also because it was a good story that would like motivate the society. Throughout the journey, I learned a lot about myself because inevitably you will be scrutinized from head to toe. Like you're basically naked in front of the whole world to be judged, right? Initially, I didn't want to do it because I always associated Miss Hong Kong with something superficial and something narcissistic. I'm sorry, but I'm not offending anyone with this. It's just I associated that with myself if I were to do it. But then I was like, you know what? Actually, that's not what it is, because it's an opportunity to practice being brave and to be bold, to put yourself out there like that, you know? And everyone is gaining different values from it. So we shouldn't judge just because it looks a certain way. But anyways, what I learned the most from it is with the media pressure and with people talking about you all the time, you need to be very grounded in knowing who you are and like the things you value in yourself, because people will always talk and there is no right or wrong. The world is not black or white. So regardless of what people are saying about you, you just need to remember what your core values are and what people love about you. And like knowing that, you have something strong to work with, and you wouldn't be swayed by people who are like, oh, maybe you're fat, maybe you're this, or.
So was there, did it trigger a lot of insecurities? Because I feel like insecurity is something that most people struggle with or still coping or learning how to handle.
Yeah.
And I think that environment would probably have particularly challenged you to face your insecurity.
Yes.
And you mentioned like you would sometimes get consumed by your thoughts that it will take you so long to get ready. So I also want to know like what those thoughts are.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So to answer your question with the insecurities, I think the media put the most attention on my scar during that time, because I think it's something, it's a
different,
it's different, it's also a story, it's a good noise, a good story for them to write about. So then they asked me a lot about like, are you not insecure about your scar, are you not scared to wear bikini, and this and that, and that obviously triggered some insecurity, because I don't think any girls would like to have you know, a scar from your chest all the way down to your stomach. That's not, it's not perfection, or it's not the conventional standard of beauty. But then what I also learned is that this is who I am, and it's part of my story that reminds me to be strong and love myself and love life every day. And like, so what if people don't like it? At least it means something to me. So I think that is how I dealt with the insecurity, is just liking yourself. It's a long journey to learn how to like yourself, because I think we are always focusing on our imperfections. 100%. It's like when you have a spot down your nose, like no one can see it, but only you're focusing on it the whole time, you know. But so that, to answer your question, the overthinking bit, getting lost in my thoughts, I think about all kinds of things, like I
an impression that you're extremely curious, which is good. Like your brain is just like constantly like
firing.
Yeah. So it is a good thing, but I understand, like, I guess because if you constantly are thinking, like you do definitely need to express it.
Yes, like, exactly. Otherwise you feel suffocated with those thoughts, you know.
Yeah,
it could be positive and negative, because I think I read something that said like more than 90% of your thoughts each day is negative, or like relooping what you were thinking about before. So like very little percentage of your mind actually produce new and positive thoughts. So then I'm always ruminating between the past and the future. I'm thinking, oh, what if this happens? Or like, why didn't I do this?
Any key pillars of yours right now in your mind that's so solid that you go by them every day when you get up, just so that you have your core and your foundation very, very solid?
Key pillars. I think for me, the strongest thing would be being grateful. So every morning, the first thing I do is say five things I'm grateful for. because I think that grounds you and it also sets the foundation for the day.
Right.
And when you have a heart of gratefulness, everything is put into perspective. Because it's easy to stress over little things, like why is the water not cold? Or like, why is my coffee taking so long?
You know? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Why did I not get up because of my alarm only went up once, not twice?
Exactly. Like you stress over little things. And then you come back to the grateful moment. You're like, you know what? I'm grateful that I'm alive. And then when you say that to yourself, your brain does something magical because you're like, actually, none of this should be stressing me out because I'm here. At least I'm not hurt. I've got my limbs with me. I don't have, I've got a roof like that I'm living under. Like I've got clean water, like all the fundamental things. If you're grateful for it, then everything else is just smooth.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned about being present, right? I think because of what you experienced, it might be easier for you to now like get back to the present self. But then for people who honestly haven't had that experience, like what would you tell them to... It is so common to think about the future and the past.
Like,
how do they get back to the present?
So before I had the life and death experience, what I used to do, it's very difficult because I think you have to meditate a lot to train that muscle in your brain to be able to do that. But I think you could try and engage your senses, like feel the wind on your skin or smell whatever you can smell right now. Feel what your bum is sitting on or, you know, just like engage your senses and then count your breaths. I find that as the easiest way to just come back quickly.
I want to touch on your vulnerability because I just met you, a vibe that I get. It's like you're very open to talk about different things. And I learned to do that as well. But it'd be interesting to talk about when you're vulnerable with someone, when you're open with someone. It's not, it doesn't guarantee the best outcome, which is people are also vulnerable. And you guys kind of exchange your experience. So some people would just like, nope, bye. Or they would give you like a really negative experience. So have you have similar, you know, encounter, and what makes you, you know, who you are now, not only very present, but you're also very open to talk about different things with people and connect with people?
So being vulnerable, I think, has always been maybe a little test for me to see if this person is worthy of my time to like engage in any sort of relationship. And I mean like friendship, romantic relationship, all kinds of relationship, because at this day and age, everyone is scared to be hurt. Everyone is scared to put themselves out there. And everyone has this like huge wall, like defensive mechanism, just like, oh, if I love this person too much, they won't love me back. If I'm too nice to them, they will take me for granted. If I show who I am, they might walk away. Like there's so many ifs and stuff. And it happens for me as well. But then my core value is just, first of all, to establish any kind of meaningful relationship, you need to be naked. And I mean metaphorically, or you can be...
Hey, there's a retreat that is like that.
So you're naked and you're like, look, this is who I am. I tell you everything. And I put full trust in you that you're going to accept me. And that I will try and accept you as well. And if it doesn't happen, then... never mind. It's better than you giving a little and a little. You know, my mom called that squeezing toothpaste. Like you're giving a little and a little, and you never really get to know that person that well. And like you never will establish real soul connections. And this is what you're looking for in life.
You know, speaking of this, now I've reflected on the friends that I really truly connected with. There are a couple of elements that we're not there, and that's why we could be naked to each other. I think one is ego. And two, it's like feeling that there's a need of competitions. I think with those two elements are the key like factors why some people always have a wall up. You know?
But I think those two are stemmed from shame.
Potentially as well.
For a lot of people that I have a connection with, when I really get to know them on a deeper level, yes, it's the ego thing. But then even deeper in a level, they're like, oh, what if I get rejected? I will feel very shameful if I get rejected because I would doubt my self-worth. Or the competition thing. If you're so much better than me in terms of XYZ, then I am not enough. So I feel shameful about myself. So it's
like protecting their own.
Yeah.
It's the idea of the self, which is the ego.
Yeah.
So feeling inadequate. This quote that I really like, the real way to live is for the I to die before you die. For the I, as I mean the self, the ego. Because I also had a moment, and the real way to live is for the I, like I to die before you die.
Die.
Yeah.
I like that.
It's like for that. The ego to die, because I also had a moment, oh, I forgot to share this. I had a moment of ego death right before the surgery. Because I was like, oh my God, what if I don't wake up from the surgery? What do I, how do I feel now, you know, before I get put to sleep? And I felt a moment of ego death where, I know it sounds very hippie, but it felt like I was interconnected with everything. Like I felt so much love, even though I was so scared, but I felt like there were no boundaries between me and others, because the ego is usually the strongest when you're ruminating between the past and the future. But when you only have the now, the ego is quiet. Don't you think? Like whenever the voice in your head is talking, it's always fear or regret.
It's always,
But in the now, exactly, in the now there's no threat, there's no danger. Like right now at this moment, there's only love.
To complicate this topic even further.
I love the ego topic.
It's just some people are thinking, what is happiness? You do all this groundwork, you do all this analysis of yourself, to do all the introspection work. You want to be more, you want to be happier, right? But then what if someone doesn't need to do that? Everything is just simple to them in life, and they don't really have to do all that journaling and stuff to understand the emotion. They just see emotion as an emotion. And get over with it and just live life. And that's their version of reality and happiness. And who says we have to do that then? Because like this person was just listening to the podcast and threw me this question. I was like, oh, that is an interesting perspective. Because that person has never seen a need for him or her to do that. So I was like, right, if that works for you, good. But I'm just thinking whether there's really such a group of person that really don't need this at all, you know?
I feel like sometimes what I call those people, I call them like emotionally unavailable group of people.
Emotionally unavailable. Exactly.
You know? I don't know if they really need it or not, but I've met someone, which I also respect, like, that they just don't have either the capacity or the need, as Rita said, to, like us, we break down emotions a lot because we see value in them. We think that emotions are useful for us to be a better self. And I think for some people, they are already, maybe they have a different way of like
approaching
outlet, a different outlet,
potentially maybe doing sports or I don't know,
and different personality types as well. Because I also listened to this TED talk somewhere that I talked about how grateful someone is actually very much genetically determined. So some people are naturally more grateful than others to be born with, right? So then like deducing from that, it also means that a lot of people naturally, they just don't have that space to need to think about all these overthinking things. And ignorance is a bliss, because like those people are happy. But then again, there's no right or wrong. Everyone have their own way of dealing with this reality.
But do you feel like you've influenced more of your circle to think with like a growth mindset? Everyone might have a different growth mindset, like a way of thinking, right? But would you say you have either influenced or you've now surrounded more people in your circle that share like the same mentality?
In London, I had a very tight group of friends who share the same core values. I think they're all like that. Every time we meet, we'll have like a couple glasses of wine and then we'll just have a session where we talk about the books we've read and the new ideas. And it's like an enlightenment session of just like 2 hours where we exchange ideas. And in Hong Kong, I feel like it's harder. I think because back in the days, being in university is easier to find your group of tribe, right? And back in Hong Kong, I hope I'm making my friends think more of that. I mean, my close friends, definitely, with Bas as well. We like spend a lot of time exchanging ideas. But yeah, I do think they influence me in their way of being more practical, because I spend a lot of time in my head and then I probably also give them more ideas. Yeah. How about you guys?
The reason why we started Unlabel Effect was because, well, we've met at the age of 12. We've been growing like on our at a different pace, obviously, with like different directions in life.
Yeah.
But then we would always gather and talk about emotional issues or ideas,
just
or
growth. Growth, life.
Yeah. And then we were saying, like, look, we're talking about this, but we realized that no one else outside felt like it's a normal conversation that you can have with your friends like easily, right?
Yeah.
So we thought, let's start a podcast and talk about things like this.
I mean, it's beautiful you guys started this as well, because I always just thought, like, where could I find a group of people who's also into these kind of topics? Because you can't just go to a bar and be like, hey, you want to talk about the meaning of life? Or like what you learned last week, you know?
Well, book you read recently.
Yeah, exactly. They were like, book club maybe?
Yeah, no, we definitely want to connect like more people like this. That is our purpose. We want to start with podcasts and then slowly grow into like a community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would love to join that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So before I wrap up,
there's
one question that we would always ask our guest.
Yeah.
Because we call the unlabeling effect. If there is one thing that you can unlabel, any like taboos or any, you know, stigma that you think would help people or stimulate people to think, what would it be?
So I think there's a common societal label that says vulnerability is a sign of weakness.
Mm.
I would say vulnerability is actually the biggest sign of bravery, because for you to be comfortable enough in your own skin to put yourself out there and to also have no fear of how the world is going to see you or accept you or not, that is beautiful. And that's the only way to establishing any meaningful relationship with yourself or with any other person.
Love that. Thank you, Raina.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me, guys.
I love it. Yeah. I love the conversation today.
Thank you for tuning in. And let's continue the conversation on Instagram at Unlabeling Effect. Please subscribe to our podcast on Spotify and iTunes and give us a rating. Until then, dare to feel, dare to be real.